شهداء علشان يعلوا في مصر وقفوا يهتفوا شهداء وما همهمش يموتوا بيها وينزفوا شهداء.
Hi, I'm Antonio Gonzalez from Strategy Session. In accordance with the Pacifica mission promoting a lasting understanding between nations and between the individuals of all nations, races, creeds, and colors, KPFK Radio would like to make listeners aware of the campaign to remove Cuba from the U.S. list of nations sponsoring terrorism. A petition to President Obama to remove Cuba from the terrorist list is available now at www.log.org. That's www.log.org.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Samer Shahada, who's a professor of Middle East politics at the University of Oklahoma. He's the author of Shop Floor, Culture and Politics in Egypt, and his most recent book is Islamist Politics in the Middle East, Movements and Change. Welcome to Background Briefing, Samer Shahada.
Thanks for having me.
And Egypt's top generals today, Monday, gave President Mohamed Morsi 48 hours to respond to these weeks of protests, which culminated yesterday with millions in Tahrir Square, declaring that if he didn't respond or settle the issue, then the military leaders themselves would impose their own roadmap to resolve this political crisis. What does that mean? I mean, it sounds like a little bit like SCAFE, the Supreme Council for the Armed Forces, is back in business or will be back in business if they're ever out of business.
Not exactly. Certainly, the Minister of Defense now is very different than the previous one, much younger. He hasn't been Minister of Defense for 25 years and is not necessarily Mubarak crony. But you're certainly correct that it is a threat, certainly, to Mr. Morsi. It would mean the military being more involved in politics, possibly even in front of the curtain as opposed to behind the curtain, as it has been, and so on. And in one sense, although one can understand why they would make a statement like this, it would also subvert the democratic process, meaning that it would potentially remove a democratically elected president through non-constitutional means. So there are many things going on. Certainly it's a form of pressure applied to Mr. Morsi to make concessions and to some kind of a compromise with the opposition. At the same time, there is now no incentive for the opposition to compromise with Mr. Morsi. I can imagine that from their perspective, if they simply waited out for 48 hours, the military will intervene, remove or sideline Mr. Morsi in a way, and some kind of a roadmap, as they have called it, would proceed.
I guess that opinion is reflected in a statement from Al-Aswani, the prominent Egyptian writer, who basically said, enough is enough. It has been decided for Mr. Morsi. Now we are waiting for him to understand. And that sort of contempt, I think, indicates the problem that so many Egyptians have with Morsi is that he is autocratic and dictatorial and somewhat boneheaded, even though he keeps talking about the wisdom that's coming forth from him. I understand that the final speech he made was not replete with wisdom, but basically was a rehash of, you know, old Muslim Brotherhood canards and nostrums.
Well, I would certainly agree that boneheaded is one way to characterize him. Certainly stubborn, divisive, incompetent leadership, and autocratic tendencies. But we can't go too far and equate his rule with Mr. Mubarak's rule, which some people have been, in Egypt and elsewhere, have been quick to do. And you're right that the speech certainly wasn't effective. That is, the speech that he made several days ago to the Egyptian people wasn't effective at somehow absorbing anger and so on and discouraging those to go out. Nor was it effective in the sense that it provided some incentives for opposition figures in the National Salvation Front or the rebel movement or the June 30th movement to try to sit at a table with him and negotiate something. And, of course, they have quite legitimate concerns, and that is he's talked about concessions and negotiation in the past, and he's really been willing to do very little of that. So why should they return to the negotiating table? And certainly the crisis is largely of Mr. Morsi and the Muslim Brotherhood's making. Now, blame does need to go around to others as well, but certainly the condition that Egypt is in now, and many people don't realize that there are and have been diesel shortages. There have been gasoline shortages with people having to wait in line for hours. There have been electricity shortages. The economy is deteriorating and so on. And hardly any, if any, of the pledges and promises that Mr. Morsi made when he first came to office of restoring security, of cleaning up the streets, and that is getting the garbage off the streets and so on, none of those things have really materialized. Of course, Egypt has had problems for many, many years, and not all of it is Mr. Morsi's fault, but he has not delivered on what he promised, and that's one of the reasons why regular people who aren't necessarily involved in politics are angered.
Again, I'm speaking with Samer Shahata, who is a professor of Middle East politics at the University of Oklahoma and the author of Shop Floor, Culture and Politics in Egypt. And his most recent book is Islamist Politics in the Middle East, Movements and Change. Well, it would seem that Mr. Morsi's options are somewhat limited. He could, you know, if he's not told to do so by the military, he could cut short his term, resign, call for early elections, or he could share power with the opposition. He may become prime minister or something like that. Or I think the most likely option would be to try and rally his supporters to take to the streets. And we've seen pictures of them in kind of homemade paramilitary gear with helmets and shields, etc., and clubs. That's the worst prospect, is it not?
Well, none of the prospects are good, but I think you're right if Mr. Morsi reads the situation properly. Perhaps the best outcome now with the cards that he's been dealt from the military are a call for early elections. And if he were not to run for election, if they wanted to, another Muslim Brotherhood candidate could run. I don't suspect that they would win, but that in some senses might be the best outcome at this stage. Now, of course, that's different than a day or two ago when his best possible outcome, I think, could have been remaining in power for the remainder of his term, three more years, and so on. So nothing looks very good right now for Mr. Morsi or the Muslim Brotherhood or his Freedom and Justice Party. At the same time, there is something important to be said that sometimes gets lost in this, which is that there will never be a stable Egyptian politics without the inclusion of the Muslim Brotherhood in politics as a political player. Not their domination of politics, but their inclusion. And so any attempt to exclude them from politics is certain to lead to political instability. And that's also another dilemma that needs to be worked out in the coming days, weeks, and months, with some military intervention and a new roadmap, as it were, for Egypt.
Well, the opposition group, Tamarod Rebellion, they have gathered 22 million signatures calling for Morsi to step down. They have just, following the army's ultimatum of 48 hours for Morsi to get his act together, they're proclaiming now that the army is sided with the people. You mentioned, Samer Shahata, the possibility of another Muslim candidate running if Morsi were to call for new elections to take place soon. Wasn't there a more liberal Muslim Brotherhood candidate who didn't make it, along with a fairly popular socialist candidate who came real close to making it in the last elections?
Well, that's right. And in fact, the person you have in mind is a gentleman by the name of Abd al-Min'im Abu Futuh. And he was a member of the Muslim Brotherhood up until several years ago. In fact, he was one of the leaders, kind of the progressive wing of the organization, up until he resigned or was forced to resign because he decided to run for president against the position of the organization at the time. He's considered by many, not all, to be much more liberal, much more progressive, possibly sincere about equal citizenship for all and so on. And I think there is some truth to that, you know, having met him a number of times and following some of his writings and so on. Now, he's potentially somebody who could serve as a bridge, and that is have some support among some Islamists and so on. And also, I think he would be someone who would be unwilling to repress the Muslim Brotherhood completely in an exclusionary fashion that would, I think, be damaging. But at the same time, there would be some in the Egyptian center, some liberal and so on support for him. But of course, one never knows who could emerge. Other people are more divisive, and so on. And of course, all of this is contextually specific. I mean, after what we've seen the last few days, someone who might not normally win in a general election could emerge as a president, if that were to be the case. But again, I don't think there's going to be, as part of this new roadmap, a call for presidential elections, you know, in the short term. I don't think that's something that the military is likely to do. It might be 6 months or something like that before we see presidential elections in Egypt again.
So what about the parliament? They don't appear to be effective. They're dominated by the Muslim Brotherhood, and you suggested that the Muslim Brotherhood is considerably less popular than they were before because of Morsi's misrule. And the second biggest bloc in the parliament, of course, are the Salafists, who came out of nowhere. And the Salafis apparently have been funded by Saudi Arabia and Qatar, and they're, you know, responsible for some of the murder of the Shias the other day. They're really hardcore theocrats, aren't they?
Yes, many of them are. And you know, to be precise, the lower house of parliament, the more important house of parliament, was dissolved by a judicial order some time ago. So what we have now is the upper house of parliament, the Shura Council, which really isn't representative of anything. I mean, it hasn't historically been important in the past. It couldn't actually propose legislation. It was more, had an advisory role, and that's why only about 5% of the registered voters turned out to vote in the election to elect those people. And now, because of the situation and because the lower house was disbanded by judicial order, they find themselves as a legislature in this awkward, strange position. And you're right, they are dominated by Islamists. So I think, and you know, one of the things that has become clear over the last few weeks, but certainly from yesterday's protests, is the idea that Islamists necessarily dominate politics and are hegemonic across the Middle East is wrong. It's flawed. There are a diversity of viewpoints. There's pluralism within the Islamist political camps. You've mentioned yourself the Salafists. We've talked about this other gentleman who was a breakaway person from the Muslim Brotherhood, who's a bit more progressive. So that being said, Islamism isn't going to go away, and any elections in the future, parliamentary or presidential elections, are likely to have some Islamist candidates present.
And you mentioned, Shlomo Sihada, the Defense Minister, General Abdel Fattah el-Sisi. He's a younger guy. He's not a part of the older defense establishment, but the defense establishment is so entrenched. They have their own industries. They continually funded by the U.S. as a result of the Camp David Agreement. And my understanding is that the U.S. ambassador in Cairo has not been particularly effective and managed to alienate a lot of people there by giving the perception that she supports the Muslim Brotherhood government. And of course, on the street, amongst the kind of conspiracy theories on the street, a lot of people apparently believe the U.S. is responsible for putting the Muslim Brotherhood in. My understanding is if the U.S. has any close ties at all, it's with the Egyptian military.
Well, that's correct, and it's a historical relationship, as you mentioned, as a result of the Camp David Accords. The United States is committed to providing about $1.3 billion to the Egyptian military annually, and there have been close ties, and of course there's also joint military exercises. In fact, they're going to happen, I believe, in a few months at Bright Star and so on. And so, and there are military purchases and all kinds of things. So, yes, certainly the United States sees the military and has seen the military as friendly and interlocutor and so on, essential for American interests in the region, whatever that may be, you know, the maintenance of the Egyptian-Israeli peace accords and other kinds of things. And there has been criticism of Ambassador Ann Patterson, some of it justified, some of it not so justified. And I don't think anybody who knows the situation could really come to the legitimate conclusion that the United States installed Mr. Morsi or the Muslim Brotherhood as president. That's not the case. But at the time, the United States was calling for votes to be counted and for the winner to be announced based on the number of votes, and I think that happened to be Mr. Morsi as opposed to the other person. And, of course, because the military assistance has continued, and because American leaders have met Mr. Morsi in Cairo, although he has not met Mr. Obama here at the White House, which is something that he's wanted to do, people in Egypt critical of the Brotherhood get the impression that this is support for the Muslim Brotherhood. And, of course, the answer to that, I think, on the side of American officials, rightly or wrongly, is no, you know, we're supporting the legitimately elected government and president of Egypt. But you're certainly right that perhaps principles of equal citizenship and so on have not been emphasized enough by, I mean, to some extent, by American officials.
But conspiracy theories are fairly pervasive, are they not, on the street, if you will, in both the Arab Middle East and in Iran in particular. The Iranians, for example, apparently majority blame the U.S. for imposing the Ayatollahs on them, for choosing the Ayatollahs from one dictatorship to another, which I don't think was the case. I think the U.S. was completely blindsided by the fall of the Shah and by the emergence of Ayatollah Khomeini. And I think they were embarrassed by the Mubarak and their support for him. And I'm not sure they knew what to do about, and they haven't known what to do since. I mean, this is a situation that the U.S. doesn't control, but everybody seems to think the U.S. does control it. At least that's my analysis.
Well, I think there's a large measure of truth to that. Certainly, Egyptians and Americans, in some cases, give more credit to the United States than it's due. I mean, one of the things that should have become clear in the aftermath of the uprisings in Tunisia and Egypt and Yemen and Libya and Syria and so on is that the United States is not all-powerful and doesn't control the course of events, and people rose up and determined their fates and histories, as it were. Is the United States still important? Does it provide military aid and so on and diplomatic and political cover? Certainly. But is that what's going to determine Mr. Morsi's fate or the fate of the Muslim Brotherhood? Certainly not. It's going to be the Egyptians there, either on the street or participating in elections or other kinds of activism, that are going to determine, I think, the future course of events.
Well, just in closing, Samer Shahada, I take it that it looks as if that Morsi won't be able to get his act together in 48 hours. The opposition certainly aren't going to help. They're going to wait him out, as you pointed out. And the military will intervene and produce a new roadmap. So given what disaster it's been so far, maybe it couldn't be worse, right? I mean, maybe there's a way to get it right the next time.
Well, you know, that's one perspective. I mean, I think, as I said, my fear is primarily twofold, right? Is one that this is not a move that further consolidates Egyptian democracy. I mean, we're talking about a non-democratic, non-constitutional intervention that removes a president that was the first president in Egyptian history to be elected by popular will, even if it was only by a slight majority. So, and again, I would be in the streets in Cairo if I was there on June 30th protesting against Mr. Morsi, but nevertheless, I think that needs to be said. Secondly, and this is quite important as well, getting rid of Mr. Morsi and closing the parliamentary shop dominated by the Muslim Brotherhood is, and excluding them from politics, is not a recipe for political stability in Egypt, right? I mean, you know, that's not going to lead to, again, consolidated democracy. And in fact, one could argue that from their perspective, they're going to feel that they have had the rug pulled from out of them, that they've participated in democratic elections, won fair and square, and now they're being marginalized by the heavy hand of the military and so on. And that is not a good recipe either. That could lead to the rise of extremism among some of them, the use of violence, and it also certainly doesn't bode well for political stability in Egypt. I mean, it is difficult. It'll be difficult for whoever is in charge to do the overwhelming number of deal with the overwhelming number and magnitude of crises that the country faces, whether it's in terms of restoring security, whether it's in terms of getting the economy going back again, or trying to forge a political process that will include Egyptians forward and that they buy into. So that's a very difficult task.
Well, thank you so much for joining us here today, Sami Shahata.
My pleasure.
Again, I've been speaking with Sami Shahata, who is a professor of Middle East politics at the University of Oklahoma. He's the author of Shop Floor, Culture and Politics in Egypt, and his most recent book is Islamist Politics in the Middle East, Movements and Change. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back doing an update on the latest on Edward Snowden, who has applied for political asylum in Russia.
Then you win.
I heard him say the revolution won't be televised. Al Jazeera proved him wrong. Twitter has him paralyzed. 80 million strong and ain't no longer gonna be terrorized. Organized, mobilized, vocalized. On the side of truth, the Madunya's living proof that it's a matter of time for the chickens home to roost. Bu Azizi lit the poof. And it slowly ignited the fire within every people to fight it. From Tunis to Khan Yunis, the new moon shines bright as the man's...